Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I love gymnastics. All the breathtaking, gravity-defying moves that seem simultaneously impossible and effortless. As a fan and enthusiast, I was deeply disappointed when I heard four-time Olympic gold medalist Simone Biles explain that she was withdrawing from the team final and later from the individual all-around finals.
Just felt like it would be a little bit better to take a back seat, work on my mindfulness, and I knew that the girls would do an absolutely great job, and I didn't want to risk the team a medal for kind of my screw-ups because they've worked way too hard for that.
And as a fan, I was sad to lose the opportunity to watch Biles perform. As a person, what made me far more sad was learning the reason why.
And it's been really stressful. This Olympic Games been a long year. So just a lot of different variables. And I think we're just a little bit too stressed out. But we should be out here having fun. And sometimes that's not the case.
With me to discuss the expectations for young women in gymnastics is someone who understands it better than anyone. I'm thrilled to introduce Dominique Dawes, a three-time Olympian and Olympic gold medalist who was the first African-American woman to win an individual event medal, with her bronze medal winning floor performance in 1996. She's also the owner of Dominique Dawes Gymnastics Academy. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, I know that it is a tight community of gymnasts, and without, you know, revealing anything that might be, personal, I'm just wondering if you've had an opportunity to talk with either Simone Biles or with her family, and if you know how she's doing.
No, I have not. I did reach out to her dad prior to the start of the 2020 Olympic Games when there was an announcement about a postponement. I just put myself in her shoes back then, thinking a whole nother year to have to train for an Olympic Games would be an arduous task. And I asked him if she would stick it out for one more year to make it to the Tokyo Olympics that would be happening in 2021. And he said, yeah, she's going to give it a shot. And I have not reached out since, but during everything that has come to light, I do plan on reaching out to her family as well.
The very fact that we're having this Olympics in 2021 is already indicative of a kind of weirdness or difference, additional pressure that so many athletes are experiencing as a result of this. I am never going to go to the Olympics, except maybe as a spectator. Can you help us to understand something about the kind of pressure associated with participating in the Olympic Games?
Melissa, think of this. I started the sport of gymnastics when I was 6 years old and fell in love with the sport immediately just because of the ability to do flips and needing high energy and strength and flexibility. And I had so much fun initially with my teammates. Then at the age of 11 years old, it started becoming a job. There was a focus on the Olympics. So from age 11 to 15 years old, there was that 4-year commitment of altering my training schedule to qualify to my first Olympic Games at 15 years old. All of these athletes, they have been committing years and years and years. And for many of these gymnasts out there, they have sacrificed their whole childhood for an opportunity to make an Olympic Games. And then with the postponement, another year of training, another year of the physical, the emotional, the psychological, and the social ramifications is a lot on these young athletes. And still with the uncertainty, if there were even going to be an Olympic Games in 2021, I can't imagine what these athletes have gone through, and they've persevered through so much. However, now we are talking about the importance of mental health, and I'm not surprised because they do endure a lot.
When we're talking about Olympic athletes, zero in for me on young women gymnasts. Everyone has high physical demands, but there's also a kind of performative demand associated with gymnastics, right? We want to see our gymnasts, especially our female gymnasts, smile. Like, we want to see you all having a good time. Is there an added or a different kind of pressure associated with that?
There is a focus on perfectionism, and there is constant critique. And so you are always at a young age taught to strive for that perfect 10. And there was always a focus on what you did wrong and not enough focus on what you did right. And so as a young gymnast, you are groomed at a very young age to believe that you're never good enough, that you're not perfect, and you need to focus and be hyper-focused on your faults, so much so that you really don't take the time to celebrate your achievements. You don't take the time to appreciate how much hard work, dedication, sacrifice, commitment you or your family endures to get to a competition or to strive for the Olympics. And so that is the environment. It's focused on perfectionism and it's focused on hypersensitivity to every single flaw and imperfection you have.
Is there a way to make great gymnasts without that kind of constant critique?
There are some gyms that do it in a very positive way, where they recognize that nearly for every critique or correction they make in one athlete, they are then going to follow it up with 10 great positive things about that athlete that might have very little to do with the actual skill or the young person's work ethic, but it might be about their character. It might be about how they're a great team player. It might be about how they have such a positive attitude, or just recognizing all of those little things that these young people are doing and remembering that we need to celebrate and applaud that. I did not come from that environment. It was very harsh. It was very much focused on your imperfections. I walked into the sport of gymnastics and I have flat feet and I have bow legs. And right away, I was told that that's a deduction. I was a little perplexed because I was a young child and that was how I was born. My legs don't naturally go together. But yet when I would do a handstand, that was right away a deduction. Or my knees didn't straighten enough naturally. Or my feet didn't point as well as another gymnast. So it needs to change. There needs to be more focus on what a child is doing right and not focusing on maybe a certain look that not everyone has.
I wonder also, as you're talking about this, the harshness, the criticism in the environment, you were obviously part of the 1996 team, the Magnificent Seven, and you were there when Carrie Strug, who was suffering from a severe leg injury, still made the decision to do her vault. And it was a decision, clearly, there was a lot of pressure. We could all see it. Maybe even we as fans were giving that pressure. I'm wondering if it's hard for young women in gymnastics to be able to say no.
That was actually brilliant that you brought up that correlation of Carrie Strug, one of the most memorable, iconic moments in the sport of gymnastics. People remember that still to this day, and it's been 25 years since we won gold. She was willing to sacrifice her physical health for, in her mind, the betterment of the team, for her country, what she had sacrificed her whole childhood for. She was willing to take that risk. Simone Biles, the greatest athlete out there, going for her second Olympic Games, had a mental block, but learned to listen to her inner voice. And she made the decision, the courageous decision, and the very humble decision to say, this is not worth the risk of my mental health, nor my possible physical health. And so what Carrie Strug did was viewed as very heroic, but it is a sign of what type of culture the sport of gymnastics breeded, where one was going to sacrifice their physical health in hopes of getting on top of a podium. It's not worth that risk, even though that was such an iconic moment, so memorable, and I feel blessed to have been on that team in some regard. It's not something that I would ever want any of my four children to ever endure. I want them to have an inner voice that speaks to them loud and clear and tells them when something is too much, either mentally and or physically, and they know how to say no.
Did you ever want to quit?
Every week. I say that all the time. I've been made motivational talks now for 25 years. And in the beginning, I was very politically correct. And I would say how great of an experience it was and how thankful I was with certain things in the sport. And then I started to wise up. And what allowed me to gain this wisdom is motherhood. Mm-hmm. And I recognized, wow, I don't want my children to go through what I went through. And you start processing things. And in 2016, when everything came out, with regards to the sexual abuses of Larry Nassar, someone that I knew for 10 years of my childhood. He was the Olympic team doctor. He was there every step of the way. I then became very aware of how damaging and unhealthy the culture was in the sport of gymnastics, and how when I wanted to quit, you're really not allowed to quit. I almost at one point thought it was a blessing that I didn't have the opportunity to quit. But now as a 44-year-old woman, wife, and mother, that in itself is very harmful. These young athletes need to have inner voices that they trust, that they hear, and that they are guided by. And it should not be this very controlled environment based on fear, based on silence, and based on intimidation. And that's what it was about back then.
As you're talking about the inner voice, I'm thinking about the fact that that Simone Biles talked about experiencing the twisties. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that is physically and how that might also be related to this inner voice that you're just talking about?
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary. I went through emotional blocks constantly throughout my career. I saw teammates that went through mental blocks where they would balk. They would stop midair because they lost a sense of their spatial awareness, and some injured themselves. But they all were affected emotionally greatly, full of fear, full of anxiety. Some still have it today. I went through mental blocks, and all you have to do is look at a number of my performances on YouTube. And it's so hard for me to watch today. But you will listen to the commentators talk about, wow, Dominique, I don't know if she's going to get it together in her warm-up. She was really off in her warm-up prior to this competition. Let's see if she can do it. And many times it was me facing a mental block, forgetting how to twist, forgetting how to do a particular move. And my coach used to always say, analysis paralysis, you're overthinking it. That's very common in the sport of gymnastics. The paralysis part, though, can lead to you completely freezing, doing a skill, balking, and then injuring yourself. And so the twisties, which is what today's generation calls it, we didn't necessarily have a name for it back then, it was just balking, is very terrifying. And that's what Simone experienced during the competition and made the decision that was best for her to back away.
I'm wondering if, I acknowledge that neither one of us are clinical psychologists, but I'm wondering if those twisties or that balking, or it's almost like your body or your brain is saying no, or saying, I'm not sure. Could that be related to the kinds of adverse experiences? And it's not to say that gymnastics is all bad, right? But the mm-hmm. adverse experiences of criticism, of not having you trust your own inner voice. And as we know in Simone's case, also an experience of abuse at the hands of Nassar, who yeah. was supposed to be someone there to help her.
Yeah, these twisties are things that many gymnasts face that are not even training for the Olympic Games, that are faced with this even at a lower level, competitive level kid, and many times it is your environment. What we are doing are very difficult maneuvers, even as a 8, 9, and 10-year-old in the sport of gymnastics. But much of it is the environment. It's the culture you're in. If you're feeling the fear, if you're feeling the intimidation, if you're feeling the pressure, if you're feeling as if you don't have a voice, if you're feeling that you are completely controlled and you don't have a choice, that many times will happen. And it's very hard for you to get yourself out of it and feel secure and comfortable enough to try again. I went through many, many mental blocks, and I know many athletes have. And I love today that Simone Biles is speaking out and saying that she's listening to her inner voice, and that right now she's doing what's best for her mentally as well as for her physically. There was one quote that I read that she said she's battling her mind, you know, and there's a lot going on. She feels the weight of the world on her shoulders. That's a lot. And we need to recognize that she's human, and that if she needs to take a break during an Olympic Games, and she has the right to take a break.
Dominique Dawes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
After Simone Biles first announced she would not compete in the team finals, the Takeaway reached out to former USA gymnasts for their reaction. And although she was unable to join us on air, 1996 team gold medalist Dominique Mosciano sent us a statement regarding Biles' decision. It reads in part, quote, "Competing at such an elite, world-class level can take a toll on the mind and body. It's sometimes easy for people to forget that even a GOAT athlete like Simone Biles is still a human being." GOAT, of course, means greatest of all time. After Biles decided also to step back from the individual all-around competition, Mosciano tweeted this, quote, "I was 14 years old with a tibial stress fracture, left alone with no cervical spine exam after this fall. I competed in the Olympic floor final minutes later. Simone Biles' decision demonstrates that we have a say in our own health, a say I never felt I had as an Olympian." Talking with me now is someone who's familiar with the pressure placed on young women in sports to succeed. Chloe Angel, a contributing editor at MarieClaire.com and author of Turning Point, How a New Generation of Dancers is Saving Ballet from Itself. Chloe, it is so lovely to have you with us.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, you were a fairly serious gymnast yourself. What are some of the things that you saw firsthand and some of the fears you had?
One of the reasons why gymnastics is a sport that is so popular among young women, young girls, young people in general, is that a lot of us didn't really understand concepts like physics and paralysis. A lot of us really didn't understand just how dangerous the things we were doing were and could be. And one of the things I found as I got older, and older by gymnastic standards means like 12 or 13, is that we were really risking head and neck injury every time we competed, every time we practiced. When something's not right in your mind, when you aren't sure that you really have what it takes, you know, as you take off to land it safely, to complete it safely, it can be devastating. And I do want to say, just because there isn't a risk of catastrophic injury doesn't mean you shouldn't feel free to take a day off. You know, things should not have to rise to that level in order for a gymnast of any level, including the greatest of all time, to say, I'm not in the right headspace for this and I shouldn't have to take risks in front of the entire world because that's what's expected of me.
I kept thinking about this language of the twisties, as Dominic Dawes called it, balking. Is that an experience that you ever had?
Yeah. It is one of the scariest experiences I've ever had, and 20 years later, I still have nightmares about it. Balking is one of the most dangerous things you can do in gymnastics, apart from all of the other dangerous things you can do. All of the other dangerous things are intentional. Balking is when your brain sabotages you halfway through a skill when you're in the air. I saw teammates break their elbows balking. I saw teammates land on their heads and necks from balking. You know, gymnastics is all about controlling your body in space. And what happens when you balk or when you get the twisties is your brain just stops cooperating halfway through that space. And it's absolutely terrifying.
It occurs to me that as you've talked about aesthetic athletics, right? In other words, not only do we want to see these gymnasts complete these extraordinary feats, we also want to see them do it and look like they're having a fun and have them smile, have them make us feel good about watching it. It feels a lot like ballet in that way. And I recently read your new book around ballet and the risks and the ways that people push through pain. Is this in part unique to young women and our expectations, not only that they do this, but that they do it and look feminine, cute, adorable, and happy?
Or that they relieve us as spectators of any discomfort that we might feel when we think about the toll that this takes on their bodies, on their minds, on their lives outside of the gym. You know, sports are like supposedly about the triumph of the human spirit, but only in the service of winning, not in the service of, as in the case of Simone Biles, like protecting that human spirit. What that really means is that people expect sports to be about, or, you know, in the case of, you know, other athletics like ballet, doing whatever it takes to win, doing whatever it takes to be the best, even if that means breaking yourself, breaking your human spirit, breaking your ankles, breaking, you know, in Simone's case, multiple toes. She's competing on multiple fractured toes right now. And so I think this is a moment for people who care about sports to ask themselves what it is they value and why. And if the answer is, I value the people who do it because they're people, even if that means sometimes I don't get to watch my version of the triumph of the human spirit pushing through adversity no matter what, that should feel like a bit of a wake-up call.
Is it uniquely American to say sacrifice it all, even your actual physical self, even your mental health, even maybe your life, to pursue your dream?
I don't know if it's uniquely American, but it does feel like it is embedded in the American psyche, this idea that the dream is sacred and anything you sacrifice in service of that dream is acceptable, valid, inspirational even. You know, I saw lots of people comparing Biles's vault and her decision after that vault to Kerry Strug's supposed decision to do her second vault in the Atlanta Games on Dominique Dawes's, on her team. A lot of people look back at that moment in 1996 as a moment, as an inspiring moment, as one that sort of captured the spirit of the Games. And that worries me, you know, the idea that you should sacrifice your chance at competing in college, which Kerry Strug did, your chance of ever practicing your sport ever again, for a gold medal, on behalf of your country. That leaves a very, very sour taste in my mouth. So I don't know if it is uniquely American, but I think it is so embedded in the American way of looking at competition and achievement of one's dream that it's very difficult for some American spectators to understand why what Simone Biles did was the right thing to do.
Chloe Angel is contributing editor at MarieClaire.com and author of Turning Point, How a New Generation of Dancers is Saving Ballet from Itself. Chloe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have you ever pushed yourself too far physically or mentally at work or in your personal life? What toll did that take on you?
My name is Ravia, and I'm calling from Torrance, California. My last 6 months at work were hell because I would push myself to keep up physically with my coworkers. And I didn't understand why I got tired so quickly and why I was left with such long-lasting pain in my body when I did. It resulted in me having to take a lot of extra days off and even coming in late to work or calling in sick because I just simply could not get out of bed because of the pain and the exhaustion. After I was terminated for reasons related to this, I was allowed to recover at length at home and sort of grow to understand my physical needs and my limitations.
This is Karen from Covina, California. I was a professional dancer for years, and I used to push my body really hard to get the desired results, but nothing compared to later in my career when I started doing marketing tours and press events. Sometimes I would actually stay awake for up to 36 hours, spending many of those hours on my feet. It is very brutal to do that, and I have suffered a lot of physical and mental burnout.
I'm a nurse in a busy emergency room in the Bronx, New York. I have burnt out from work. I am very tired and don't even want to, you know, take care of my own family. Very depressed. Makes me not feel good in general. It's just very stressful, all of it.
Hi, this is John from Richmond, California. I did overextend myself a few years back as an elementary school teacher, and I needed to step away for health reasons. I found taking time with my family and kids, along with meditating and doing some personal care, was the key to getting past it all.
I had a job where I should have worked with 4 or 5 others with the same skill set, but I was the only one with that skill set, and I was grossly overworked. I started having heart palpitations and was prescribed a heart monitor. Then I lost my job and my palpitations stopped immediately. I felt wonderful, and not having a job and not knowing where my income would be coming from was far less stressful than that job. Life has been nothing but roses since then. And this is Jeanette Briggs calling from Hurdle Mills, North Carolina.
Hi, I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia. When I was younger, I was working on a job where I was being discriminated against due to my gender, so I worked 7 days a week so that I could be taken seriously like the men. This eventually caused me to get a chronic illness that presented itself as chronic tonsillitis and IBS. It became so bad that I actually had to quit my job and move back in with my parents. It also caused me to dip into my worst out of depression and anxiety that I'm still 4 years later recovering from.
I did push myself for many years. I was a dance performer, a dance teacher and choreographer, and worked 8 to 10 hours a day. I gradually lessened my schedule over several years, but I was a mess, sometimes during and at the end of that career. I was exhausted in physical and emotional pain, depleted. Dance was my life and passion, and I'm so grateful I was able to make a living, but it could be very trying. I suffered from depression and anxiety through all of it. My name is Priscilla Regalado, and I'm calling from Richmond, California.
Hi, this is Deborah. I'm calling from Cascade, Colorado. After minimizing an injury that I sustained, I kept pushing myself physically until I was forced to withdraw from a graduate nursing program when I was near the completion point. I've been unable to resume the program despite having subsequently recovered from my injury.
Hi, this is Linda from Oceanside, California. Trying to finish my bachelor's degree while working full-time, taking care of an aging parent, all while being in a dysfunctional and abusive relationship, definitely took its toll on my mental health. I entered therapy and was forced to make some hard choices.
Y'all are so open with us, and we so appreciate you for it. You are all part of our family here at The Takeaway. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Continuing our conversation about Olympic gymnastics, and just a note to listeners, we're going to discuss sexual assault in this conversation. At the press conference following the USA women's gymnastics team's silver medal win, Simone Biles indicated there were many variables making this year's Olympic Games stressful. One of those factors is likely the reality that this is the first Summer Olympics since Larry Nassar was convicted in 2018 following decades of abusing the girls and young women entrusted to his care as a team doctor for America's Olympic gymnasts. Just how has the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, changed its policies and protocols to prevent harm and abuse within the Games? And is it enough? Here to help us answer these questions is Jennifer Gerson, a reporter at The 19th. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Hey, thank you so much, Melissa.
So let's just start with, what are the current sexual assault protocols in the Olympic Village?
That is a great question. The direct answer is that there is a safeguarding officer present in the villages, and there's some centers within the villages for reporting if there's an incident of sexual violence of any kind. The longer answer is, it's hard to really parse what that means in practicality for athletes. The existing protocols for sexual assault reporting as they stand today have been in place at least since 2016 through the IOC. In 2018 is when they set up these centers within the villages to make reporting seemingly easier. But if you talk to athletes and people who work with athletes, there's still question marks in terms of what this actually means and how not just easy, but kind of tenable it is to make a report and know that something's going to happen when that happens.
I'm kind of puzzling at this moment. We actually know an awful lot about sexual assault reporting and about not only the challenges and difficulties of reporting, but also that, you know, the presence of law enforcement not only doesn't always make that easier, but can sometimes actually be the source of these assaults. I'm wondering if there is, discussion with the athletes, if there's, you know, any kind of set of rules around this, like, really, law enforcement is the answer?
Well, so how the current safeguarding officer's office works within the IOC is that once a report is made by an athlete to anyone, and in theory, anyone who works with athletes, coaches, trainers, anyone who's part of the Olympic entourage in any capacity is subject to a mandatory reporting requirement. Now, whether people actually know this is another question. That's something that came up in my own reporting, that there's a lot of, maybe not lack of clarity, but a lot of people, I think, who just have not been even informed of that policy. And that's a real concern amongst athletes and people who work with athletes, that people may not know about the mandatory reporting requirements. But even after an athlete does disclose to someone, that person is then supposed to go on and make a report through the safeguarding officer in the villages. And then from that point, the safeguarding officer makes the call. Are they getting local law enforcement involved? Are they pursuing some other means of investigation? So it's even kind of tricky at that point to even parse what's even happening. I mean, for some people, I think law enforcement involvement would almost be a best case scenario to know that some action has been taken. So that's part of what's really tricky about this too. And the language around how this is structured is pretty loose. So I think there's just a real general lack of clarity for athletes and their entourages on what actually does happen when a report is filed. And I think it's a real concern for a lot of people right now.
So Jennifer, as you were sort of walking us through that, you know, I've been a college professor 20 some odd years, and it sounds an awful lot like some of the challenges that occur on college campuses with someone to whom you report, a lot of young people living together. And we know that sexual assault is a reality and a far too common one on college campuses. What do we know about the prevalence of assault in Olympic villages?
That's a great question and a great analogy, because that's something that came up in my reporting again, where that comparison to what's happening on college campuses was frequently made and is a really good point of reference and something that fortunately most people are familiar with because it is so prevalent on college campuses. And it's not that different at the Olympics. And depending on how different studies were modeled and the parameters of how, you know, those studies were set forth, you know, somewhere between 2% and 50% of athletes across the board have reported in their lifetimes experiencing some form of sexual violence, and up to 90% have reported experiencing some form of sexual harassment. So we know that sexual violence of all kinds is a real problem in athletics. And some of the risk factors for these things to occur are elite athletics, which the Olympics is certainly as elite as it gets, and traveling and being away from your kind of home base, home community, and anytime when you're participating in your sport on the road, which again is happening at the Olympics, and this year even more significantly so with what's going on with COVID and the current protocols for that, people's families aren't with them. They're really on their own at these games. So basically every major risk factor that could possibly be in place is definitely in place for the Olympics, making this a real challenge for athletes. And we know this is an issue. And now every red flag is up in terms of what could make this even more likely to happen.
Speaking of red flags, a U.S. fencer was allowed to compete in the Olympics this year, even after teammates reported accusations of sexual assault. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us a lot about, I think, the reality that exists for a lot of athletes and folks who work with athletes and are concerned about these issues. The situation with the fencer who had been part of the Columbia University fencing team at the start of his career, and that's where the allegations against him stem from, was from his time at Columbia. Again, tell us a lot about the realities of these reporting systems. You know, complaints were made within Columbia's Title IX system. Complaints have been made within the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, which is the independent organization that ever since the Nassar case has been kind of the clearinghouse for investigation of sexual assault allegations. You know, claims keep being made. People are making reports. Reporting isn't the issue, which I think, again, is the concern. The seemingly mechanisms are set up for reporting. Doesn't mean that much is actually happening from that point. And that's what's happened with this fencer. There's been 3 allegations of sexual violence against him. He's still in the Olympics, and the kind of solution that seemingly has been come up with was, well, he just won't stay at the villages, which in the times we live in, and when we know that so much of sexual violence, especially amongst athletes, from people I spoke with in my reporting over and over again, what came up was just the presence of the role that technology, phones, social media play in sometimes facilitating the situations in which sexual violence takes place. People are still on their phones, even if they aren't in the Olympic Village together, and things could be happening to help contribute to a situation that could be dangerous for some people.
Jennifer Gerson is a reporter at the 19th. Thank you for joining us and helping us remember, even as we're enjoying the games, we got to protect the athletes.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa. It's been so great speaking with you today. I really appreciate your time.
I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. If you're anything like me, you've fallen a bit in love with a guy named Ted Lasso. Yes, I'm talking about everyone's favorite fictional football coach.
Hey, how y'all doing? I'm Ted Lasso, your new coach.
In Apple TV Plus's Ted Lasso, which recently kicked off its second season, actor Jason Sudeikis plays the title character, a college football coach from Kansas who's hired to coach an English Premier League soccer team. Despite knowing nothing about the sport, Lasso wins over almost everyone he meets with his earnest, aw shucks attitude.
Hey, y'all played a heck of a game out there. We may not have won, but y'all definitely succeeded. I mean, you gave the champs 90 minutes of hell.
The show, Ted Lasso, is a far cry from the kinds of TV shows that used to dominate the airwaves. Over the past two decades, there's been a shift away from the irony that defined TV comedies like The Office, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Arrested Development, to the sincerity central to the Ted Lassos of the world. James Poniewozik recently wrote about the shift on the small screen for the New York Times. He's the chief television critic for the Times and author of Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America.
I was originally sort of inspired to think along these lines when I and my colleagues at the Times recently put together a list of the 21 best American TV comedies of the 21st century. And that kind of gives you, you know, sort of an arc of TV history. And one thing that I was seeing in that is that it sort of starts off with shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm, the American version of The Office, because we were looking at American comedies, Arrested Development, these sort of very cutting, cringe comedy-based shows with kind of an edgy, ironic sensibility. And as you go forward in time to now, you kind of feel the temperature gradient start to warm in these, to where you get more sort of heartfelt and also excellent, you know, in a very different way, comedies like Better Things, a show that I love on FX, or it was a little too late for the list, but Ted Lasso now on Apple TV, where you have much more of a focus on empathy and good feelings and a sort of a sincere sensibility, which I think reflects a lot of things in larger television and the arts and culture beyond television as well.
Let's pause on these two different concepts, ironic and sincere. So talk to me, when you say irony, what do you mean by irony in the context of these television shows?
I'm glad you asked, because I think irony is a much debated and abused term, you know, ever since Alanis Morissette and before. When I'm talking about a TV show sort of having an ironic narrative or sensibility, I don't necessarily mean, you know, cynical or nasty the way many people do it, but I mean a disconnect between the sort of authorial intent and the text, the content of the story. So in other words, in something like Ricky Gervais's The Office, you have a disconnect between how the show sees David Brent, the protagonist, and how he sees himself.
A sergeant major spends all his time training his men to be killers. He doesn't polish his own boots. He probably does polish his own boots, but, you know, it doesn't mean I have to do my own filing.
He sees himself as the hero of the story. To the show, he's the anti-hero of the story. I think that's much the case with, say, the Larry David character in Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Trick or treat.
How old are you?
13.
You look more like 16 or maybe even 17.
No, 13.
You're 13?
Yeah. Can I get some candy?
Where's your costumes?
I'm being my sister.
You're being your sister?
This is my costume. Teacher.
You're a teacher,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So can we get
Boy,
some candy
like
for him?
Yeah, no,
honestly, can we
class.
Have our candy?
Candy.
Hello?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Are you kidding?
You know, there's sort of a difference between how Larry David is on the show and how Larry David, the creator of the show, sees that character's actions. It's sort of a kind of storytelling, which also relates to things like anti-hero dramas like The Sopranos, in which the audience is expected to recognize a detachment between the show's point of view and the character's point of view.
I'm feeling like, to me, Colbert is a great example of this, that what he was saying was actually the opposite of what the show wanted you to believe.
Yeah, the version of Stephen Colbert that we saw in The Daily Show and then The Colbert Report was sort of patient zero for this kind of television irony. He was a genius. He was a master at it. For years on The Colbert Report, he played himself as a character, as sort of this blowhard commentator who was oblivious and vainglorious and is saying all these things that he himself as a person did not believe.
Now, when I saw the tweet with no context, I understood how people were offended.
The same way I, as an Irish American, was offended after reading only one line of Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. I mean, eat Irish babies, hashtag cancel Swift. Trend it.
And part of the comedy, the effect of the show, was that you recognized a difference between what the character was giving you and how the show wanted the character to represent what he was giving you. So it was the ultimate ironic performance in that he literally, because he was playing himself under his own name, you know, he sort of had to detach from himself in this work of performance art.
So let's talk about Ted Lasso, because I recently found it. I know it's going into its second season or premiering the second season, but I just found the first season and I did just fall in love with it. Like at one point I brought my 19-year-old daughter downstairs because she's heading off to be a resident advisor at her college. And I was like, you got to watch this because it's got great examples of how to be a good team leader. And I mean, what gets more sincere than like your mom calling you to watch the show, you know, to be a good team leader?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that's a great thing that TV can do for us. You know, I had a similar experience to something that I think a lot of my readers have shared with me, which is that, you know, Ted Lasso, the first season premiered last year. It's been kind of a rough year. And, you know, I think a lot of people have had this experience of, you know, I was worn down by the pandemic or by like, you know, all the mean-spiritedness in politics or this or that. And I think there is something that people respond to in this show, that it's not just an empathetic show, but it's kind of a show about empathy and how feeling empathetic, having that ability, can be powerful in the world and where it works and where it doesn't. And I think one thing that makes it brilliant too is that it's not just like a simplistic feel-good show where everything automatically works out. It really challenges the idea of whether, you know, Ted Lasso's kind of relentlessly sunny disposition is always healthy or always the best choice in every situation. And so I think it's also a case that shows that just because a show is less narratively convoluted doesn't mean that it's any less sophisticated. You know, I think it's a show that's very smart about the very sincere, direct thing that it's trying to do.
Do you think that sincerity, that directness, even that sort of complication within the context of sincerity, is a result of having lived through 4 years of the Trump administration, which did not feel particularly empathetic? And of course, the COVID-19 crisis, where you know, so many of us are separated in a very sincere and real way, separated from our loved ones, and kind of hoping like not to get back together to start throwing jabs, but like to actually be nice to one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's all of that and more. I think whenever you see, you know, cultural shifts, they have many parents, right? And you know, I think there's certainly this aspect of the pandemic when we've been cooped up for a year and a half, largely at home, often with our televisions, that people kind of sought out comfort, and they specifically sought out and turned to things that, you know, kind of invested them with this sense of community and belonging, and, you know, people trying to be with one another in a healthy way. And then, yeah, I think that there is, you know, I don't necessarily know that the political environment inspired every show that fits this category, but I think it affects the reception and the popularity of them, that we've been through this sort of political era, not just of a lot of mean-spiritedness, but often the political weaponization of irony. You know, where, you know, one thing that Donald Trump would often do was this thing of, you know, oh, I'm joking, but I'm not joking. You know, Russia, if you're listening, we'd love to see Hillary Clinton's emails. Oh, it was a joke. I was being sarcastic, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so I think that there was this sort of kind of political weaponization of this, you know, kind of trolling attitude that I think, you know, in some sense drove people to embrace, you know, a little more sincerity and a little more saying it like you mean it.
And if you, of course, mean what you say, even if sometimes what you say is mean, you just have to be accountable for it.
That's a terrific way of putting it. And yes, I agree. You know, it is a way of putting yourself out there and standing behind what you say and, you know, taking whatever lumps come from it.
So because I'm me, we have to do this. Is this sincerity move also happening in television and cultural products that are explicitly raced and gendered? So part of what I so enjoy about Ted Lasso is that he's like consistently doing these somewhat surprising, I almost hate myself for saying this, but these surprising, almost like critical race theory turns, right? Like he'll suddenly quote someone you would never expect, this kind of country white guy, you know, now living in England to quote. But I'm wondering if we can do this sort of sincerity plunge, for example, with a woman as our protagonist, or with a queer person of color, or if part of what irony did was also to provide a little protective shield for those who, you know, live at the margins of our normed society.
I think it can kind of work both ways. There's sort of different tools, irony and sincerity that can be used for different purposes. But I think you're absolutely right to pick up on this aspect of it, because, you know, on the one hand, I think that if somebody sees themselves producing something that is for, you know, a new or underrepresented group, you know, as you say, the shield and the license of irony and sarcastic humor can often be a kind of defense. You see this often, you know, sketch comedy and so forth, you know, going back to the early aughts, you know, Chappelle's Show and that sort of thing. On the other hand, I also feel that I think that one reason that you have often seen a more sincere mode of television in TV storytelling lately is that more people are being kind of brought in and allowed to tell stories. And, you know, you can have, sort of a detached attitude from somebody like, you know, David Brent or Tony Soprano, when white guys in stories have had the chance to play all sorts of characters for a long time. Whereas I think that when you are creating a story about, you know, a group that, you know, that you've seen as being underrepresented, your first choice is not necessarily going to be to spoof, or to like sort of, you know, deconstruct it. And so I think that a show, say like Insecure, a terrific show like that, or Rami on Hulu, or Master of None, or Atlanta, these will often have very complex attitudes toward their characters and their protagonists, but they also have more sympathy toward them than, say something like Arrested Development, which was much more about puncturing the hypocrisies and ridiculousnesses of, you know, characters like the Bluths. So I think this is absolutely a big factor that you're picking up on.
James Poniewozik is the chief television critic for the New York Times. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Melissa.
That's all we have for y'all today. Appreciate you tuning in. And don't worry, we're going to be right back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.